Welcome to the Team Health Beyond Clinical Medicine podcast program, what they don't teach you in residency. I'm Rob Strauss, Team Health Chief Medical Training Officer, and this podcast is not one of our regular series, but rather somewhat unique. The wonders of and necessary preparation for the upcoming solar eclipse. On April 8th, there will be a total solar eclipse crossing a swath of the United States. The next one will occur in 2044, and it's an exciting and dangerous process. Well-prepared viewers will be thrilled, while some ill-prepared people will sustain eye injuries, some permanent. What do you need to know for yourself, your families, and to advise others? Today, we're again privileged to have Dr. David Hogan share his insights. David is Team Health's Vice President of Educational Development, as well as the leader of the Emerging Infectious Disease Task Force. He and his group of physician scientists spend hours every day reviewing the latest scientific information on a variety of topics to provide us with up-to-date and usable information. He's dedicated to improving medicine as we know it. David, I'm delighted to speak with you, and I always leave our conversations with a clearer perspective on whatever topic we're discussing.
Thank you, Rob. It's great to be here.
Interestingly, astronomers are predicting that this great eclipse will be the most watched event in modern history, with an estimated 500 million people set to participate. David, why is this topic of such great interest to you?
With me, it stems back to the fact that I have been an amateur astronomer since junior high, back in the days when you actually built your own telescopes. I never ground my own mirrors, but I was able to find them. That was well before anything online, so you had to search around physically to find where you could get bits and pieces to build your telescope. But we built several throughout junior high and high school, and I've just always been fascinated by astronomy and by science. And the cool thing about astronomy is that it is one of the few sciences that is left where an amateur can still make a huge, real contribution to science.
Do you still have any of those telescopes?
I do still have many of my old telescopes. I've got five, actually, and have used them in various ways and converted them in various ways. What I have found is that it's just a lot more fun to build and use your own equipment than to go and you can get some marvelous telescopes from various manufacturers. We have, I live in Oklahoma, and we have one of the biggest suppliers of high-tech telescopes for astronomers, and they're just a short drive away from where I live. But I have a tendency to like to build and use my own as much as possible. And in particular, I still keep those around because of the citizen science opportunities. You can do things like at a particular time, you know what your location is through GPS, and you can watch a planet transit across the sun, and you time it from the time you begin to see it to the time that it leaves the solar disk, or other things like that. And you provide that information then to NASA. They have websites that are available for you to sign up and do this kind of citizen science. They then take all of that information from astronomers, and they're able to put that together in a sort of meta-analysis and improve things like how they guide or navigate a spacecraft. The spacecraft that went to Pluto, as example, had a lot of citizen science involved in helping with its navigation. So I still keep those things around because I just think they're the best. Plus, I'm used to using them. So it's something that you get hooked on the more you do it.
Very cool. I can see, if it had not been medicine, that there are so many aspects of engineering that you might have been a part of. So I know that there are eclipse chasers who get on a plane to follow an eclipse. But eclipses move across the United States at about 1,500 miles an hour. So for the rest of us, what's the best place and time to watch a total eclipse?
Well, this particular total eclipse is going to sweep from the south to the northeast direction as the moon and the sun adjust their positions a little bit and the earth rotates. And it's going to start coming in down in Texas. It'll go through and just barely clip Oklahoma, Arkansas, then through Missouri, Illinois, Ohio, New York, and then it leaves us in Maine. And that there's a wide swath that is patterned out as the eclipse or the shadow of the moon passes over the earth. And the very center of it is where you see the totality or where you see the complete eclipsing, because it's interesting that currently the size of the moon and the size of the sun in the sky are essentially the same. So we live in a very unique time in history because that has not been true starting even a few million years ago up until now. And it will not be true in the future as the moon moves a little bit farther away. But right now, they're about the same size. And so we get this experience of totality and we're able to see the external part of the sun's atmosphere, the corona, just absolutely fascinating. But you've got to, as example, you can get the information about where the viewing is and how long you'll be able to see totality on websites such, the best is NASA's website. And they have a specific website that you can just search it on any search engine and it'll bring you to it. And it demonstrates by a map where this area of eclipse can be viewed and where the specific time parameters are for the longest ability to view that totality exactly what time locally that it'll be there on the 8th. And that's the best way to know when and how to view it. But understand that, you know, seeing the totality is way cool. But you can start viewing this thing an hour or more earlier as the disk of the moon begins to occlude the sun. And you can watch it just slowly go across until you hit totality, and then it slowly recedes across. And that's pretty interesting as well.
So does it matter if you're in a rural area or city area? Do lights or smog make any difference in the viewing ability?
Clouds and smog and air quality will make a difference. The good thing about solar viewing is that it happens during the daytime. Yep. And so you're not going to be interfered with by light pollution, et cetera. The sun's pretty bright. And so we're able to view that without much problem. The biggest thing that is the bane for solar viewers is clouds. And the 2017 experience that I had, we did have a lot of clouds, but fortunately there were enough breaks in the clouds that even during totality, we were able to view it and photograph it a little bit. So even if there are clouds, it's something that's worth taking the time specifically to go out and just to try to experience, even if you're not viewing the sun necessarily. When totality hits, the temperature drops, animals change their behaviors. It's creepy, but it's also an experience that just, it really hooks you on wanting to be able to experience another and also to get interested perhaps in doing some amateur astronomy.
So David, describe why preparation is necessary beyond getting a good view and location. And what is that preparation?
The preparation mainly is education, and we can look at it from two points of view. One is the non-medical person who's being involved, and the other is the medical impact that occurs for clinicians associated with this. But the most important thing is, number one, all injuries associated with eclipses are preventable, and they're preventable with education and with just easy and straightforward safety measures. And you can then be able to observe and have a lot of fun associated with the solar eclipse. If you don't follow some of those safety procedures, and you don't get appropriate education prior to the event, then you do run a fairly high risk. The highest risk across the board are for young people. Well, why would that be? Well, most young people don't have cataracts yet. They have very clear lenses, and they're able to transmit all of that energy from the sun directly through their cornea and their anterior parts of the eye back to the retina where it can cause damage. The other thing is that most very young people have a tendency to be immortal in their minds to a bit and impervious to any kind of damage. And so they, well, it won't hurt for me to glance just a little bit through my 10-inch telescope that I just bought yesterday at the sun. I'm sure it'll be just fine. Well, it really isn't, because that kind of a setting where you're actually looking at magnified light can cause permanent retinal damage in less than a second. And so you really need to understand just some basic things, do's and don'ts. And those mostly are associated with never, ever, ever look at the sun directly. Now, they say you can look at the sun during totality without anything. And I suppose that's okay, but I don't want to recommend that to anybody. I think you need to use a viewing device or a filter anytime you're doing that. But beyond that, just getting that basic education, which really we're providing most of that here, following, adhering to those basic safety principles, and you won't get hurt and you'll have a great time and you'll be able to view things.
So can you talk to us about viewing devices and filters, what people should be considering?
Sure. If you go online right now, you will find hundreds and hundreds of thousands of places where you can go, and online you'll be able to obtain solar glasses or filters to be able to view the sun directly. And for the most part, those are okay. In 2017, we had a flooding of the American market with inferior products. And the problem with an inferior product is that you're going to damage your eyes, and they're not going to provide the protection level that you would like to have. So the important thing is there's something called the ISO, which stands for the International Standards Organization. But what they do is they look at these solar filters, and the solar filters are, they're basically kind of a mylar sheet. And they can be cut up to make little glasses or little shields that you hold up. Or you can get really tech if you're going to use a telescope to directly view, which you shouldn't. But if you're going to do that, you can buy sun filters for various types of telescopes that also have these ISO ratings. Well, the ISO rating, if you look on the thing that you're planning to buy or the one that you're planning to use, it'll have this ISO rating. And I think it's supposed to meet ISO standard 12-2. The number really doesn't matter, because that's just sort of the general standard. The ISO group itself just puts together what the standards are. And in essence, it has to be able to filter out everything except 0.0032 and thereabouts percent of all of the optical energy that's coming off of the sun. That includes visible light, that includes a diminution of UVA, UVB, which are the wavelengths that mostly cause damage, and also infrared, which doesn't typically cause as much damage unless you're viewing it through a telescope or binoculars magnified. But that's what you want to look for. And almost all of the stuff this year that's out there, if you get it through a site that's linked through NASA or you through the American Astronomical Association or a lot of the magazines like Sky and Telescope that will look at, evaluate, and approve these things, if you order through a reputable source, those are pretty good. And the only thing you want to be careful about is you go out to a convenience store and they have all those little eclipse glasses there. You want to check and make sure that they look like they're from a reputable source. I picked up some at Lowe's just a few days ago, just to have some extra ones around. But you know, I took a look at them, and they actually claim to be affiliated through the American Astronomical Society and, quote, certified. But you want to watch things like certification or approval, because the ISO people, they don't certify or approve anything. They just make a standard.
Fabulous. So I'm going to repeat that. It's an ISO 12312-2. That's really helpful, David. Thank you for that. So can you go into a little more detail for us related to the eye injuries? I know I've heard you speak about both keratitis and maculopathies. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. First and foremost, remember that this is often going to turn into a mass gathering event. Regarding the eye injuries, the most common thing that clinicians are going to see is just solar keratitis. And that's corneal burns, ultraviolet burns associated with exposure to ultraviolet radiation. Typically, when we see those sorts of injuries, it's not a huge deal. We see them frequently. We do an eye evaluation. Those typically heal on their own with a little symptomatic relief, etc. The difference between solar keratitis and the typical UV keratitis that we see is that the typical run-of-the-mill stuff that we see in the emergency department and clinics is associated with reflected solar energy that reflects off the water, reflects off sand, off of boats that are painted white, etc. And the amount of energy that you get into the eye is quite a bit lower associated with that reflected. So there's three things to look at. One is the exposure to the damaging agent, which is mostly UV in this setting, can be reflected. Okay, bad, but not horrible. Can be direct from you looking specifically at the sun. Much, much, much higher amount of energy, much less time required to result in keratopathy associated with that sort of exposure. So we're not talking reflected, we're talking direct energy. Then you can make it even worse. You can have binoculars or a telescope or something that you're using. You not only now have direct viewing, but you have focused direct viewing. And in that setting, not only does the ultraviolet, but the actual luminosity, the visible spectrum of the sun can bleach the retina, but you also now have the infrared radiation, which can burn and can burn quickly. I mean, think about holding a magnifying glass up from the sun on a leaf or something to catch it on fire, which most all of us have done at some time in the past, and then substitute that leaf with your retina, and you can see the problems that you can get into. So that's the difference with the mechanisms of injury. And you end up with corneal burns. But the problem is, if you do a good evaluation and you go, yep, they've got solar keratopathy, they got a nice corneal burn there, and here's how we'll treat that. The problem is that the amount of energy that's been imparted into that eye, if it's been enough from direct viewing with or without magnification to result in a burn to the cornea, the retina is going to have injury as well. And interestingly, because of the way our visual systems work, you don't always realize that you have a chunk of your visual field gone now because it's been burnt away. And you may notice a little scotoma, a little bit of visual defect, but typically you think, oh, you know, it's not a big deal. That'll go away. It'll heal. Well, not always. So here comes the one cardinal rule for clinicians. If you see a patient in the emergency department or clinic or in any medical activity, and you're seeing that patient for an eclipse viewing related eye injury, even if it's just apparently a corneal burn, 100% of those people need to be referred, not that day, but within a reasonable period of time, certainly within a week, to an ophthalmologist. They can do the optical tomographic evaluations that they do. And there are studies that clearly support that you can look at that retina directly or indirectly in your clinic or emergency department, and that retina will look okay. But when you do that OCT study, there you find the burn. And the problem is that when we look at something, we tend to use our best vision. And so the areas that end up being burned are the areas that are associated with our most acute and our most high resolution vision. And those can easily be burned.
David, so it sounds like the whole process can be a great thrill, or done poorly, create significant sequelae. Any final words for our audience?
I think overall, probably the most important thing is that all of these injuries are 100% preventable, and they're preventable through education. This also can make, if you're in an emergency department or clinic in an area of that's going to be close to or in an area, the path of the eclipse and the totality, this would make a great little patient education packet. Hey, by the way, the eclipse is coming. Here's a one pager on what not to do and how you may safely view it if that's what you're going to do. The other thing is that retinal injury is most likely a lot more common than we think it is associated with eclipse viewing. 100% of these folks need ophthalmology referral if you're seeing them for any kind of eclipse-related eye injury. And probably the most important thing beyond that is how you're going to view the eclipse. Direct viewing through the filters, that's fine if you watch for the ISO ratings, etc. But if you go online, you can find 100 indirect ways with making little devices with shoe boxes and other sorts of things to project the sun, using everything from very expensive lenses to lenses and cheaters. And those things are, in my opinion, a much safer way to be able to view the eclipse and have a lot of fun.
Can you suggest one or maybe two sources where people can get further information?
The number one place would be NASA. If you just go in and click on NASA.gov, right now they have two huge banners on their website that take you to information about eclipse viewing. Those sites then have probably another 10 or 20 links that you can go to for other specific information, including where you need to be when to be able to see the area or the duration of totality the longest.
David, this is, as always, both fascinating and informative. I thank you for sharing the information and your enthusiasm. I look forward to further discussions with you.
Thanks, Rob. It's been an honor to be here.
Well, thanks. I hope you've enjoyed this Beyond Clinical Medicine podcast with Dr. David Hogan. Always fascinating. If you have any questions about this topic or suggestions for other topics, please contact me at beyondclinicalmedicine.org. Thank you.